The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is That's Halaf. For the next half hour, I'll be reading excerpts of funny stories, quotes, and other anecdotes from various sources that we hope will add a few chuckles to your day. My dear listeners, we are about to close out another fine year of humorous memoirs, witty recollections, and what a better way to ring in a new year than with a couple of pretty tall tales. Our first story is an excerpt from the book A Toot Hansel Christmas Cracker, Beaufort Scales, Book 5, written by Kim M. Watt and published in 2020. This story is read from Kim's blog post found at kmwatt.com, posted on December 16, 2020. Four Calling Birds, A Toot Hansel Christmas Story. "Who's a clever boy, then?" Carlotta asked, scratching the parrot's head. "Who's the best birdie in the whole wide world?" "Birdie is," the parrot croaked, eyes drifting closed in pleasure. "Birdie's a clever boy." "Yes, he is," Carlotta said, and gave him a slice of carrot. "There you go. Eat up." She turned back to the kitchen, separated from the rest of the big living room and dining room by a squat island covered with drifts of icing sugar and almond crumbs. Bertie looked at the piece of carrot, then at the ranks of amaretti biscuits lined up on the island, and said in a rather lower voice, "Bollocks." Carlotta turned back, frowning. "What was that?" "Bertie won a biscuit," the parrot said. "Oh, you are clever. No biscuits for Bertie, though. Too much sugar for Bertie's." She started stacking the biscuits in tins, and the parrot sighed. He nibbled the carrot without much enthusiasm for a bit, then straightened up and shouted, "Show us what you got." Carlotta flapped a tea towel at him. "You just behave yourself." He gave a low whistle, dancing on his perch. "Giz a kiss. Show us your baps." "Bloody hell, Carly," Philip said, wandering in with his hands in his pockets. "Is that bird ever going to shut up?" "I don't know," she said, slapping his hand away as he reached for an amaretti and picked a different one to offer him instead. "But your language isn't helping, and I think he's still settling in." "If you say so," he said, taking the biscuit and looking from it to the one he'd reached for. "What's the difference?" "That one's a funny shape." He stared at it.
"It is?"
"Work it, baby," the parrot squawked and dropped his carrot. Philip and Carlotta looked at him. "Where did Tony get him again?" Philip asked. "He was a rescue." Bertie Wolf whistled and bobbed his head.
"From where? A strip club?"
Carlotta slapped his shoulder lightly. "He belonged to someone in Leeds, and apparently he was fine until they started building next to her. She used to let him sit on the porch, and the next thing she knew, he'd picked up all these expressions from the builders. She'd have kept him, but she runs a daycare, so it was a bit inappropriate."
"Kids probably loved it," Philip said.
"Ooh, were," Bertie added. Philip took a bite of the amaretti, scattering icing sugar all over his jumper.
"So, why do we have him?"
"Tony couldn't keep him," Carlotta said. "Not with Emily. Imagine our granddaughter's first word being bullocks."
"Or baps,"
Philip said, and she poked him in the side.
"What? He could have just been asking for a salad roll."
"Behave," she said, glancing at the clock. "I've got to go. Don't eat any of the good biscuits."
"I don't know how you tell the difference," he said, inspecting the ranks of sweet-smelling amaretti on the cooling rack,
but she was already hurrying out of the room. He selected one at random.
"Tap that booty," Bertie observed.
Philip looked at him for a moment, checked Carlotta hadn't come back downstairs, and took a biscuit to the bird.
"In honor of an impressive vocabulary," he said, as the parrot took the offering delicately in his beak. Bertie swapped the biscuit to his claw. "Thanks, mate," he said. Philip stared at him. "What?" The parrot squawked and turned his attention to the Amretti. Philip watched him for a moment, then went to put the kettle on. Smart birds, parrots. Not smart enough to actually have a conversation, though. He didn't think, anyway. He peered out the window over the sink as he waited for the kettle to boil. Three crows were huddled on the bird feeder, shoulders hunched against a fine rain, staring at Bertie. Now there were some other smart birds. Not as mouthy, though, which was probably a good thing. "Bullocks!" Bertie said, as the biscuit broke and fell to the floor. "Bertie wants his biscuit." Philip sighed and went to pick it up. Gilbert crept through the garden, his scales flushed the muted greens and browns of the winter foliage, such as it was. He hadn't quite anticipated that the gardens would be so bare, and he was worried he might be leaving some very obvious footprints, despite having fashioned tactical socks out of old scales. These left tracks that, when looked at from the right angle in low light, and if one ignored the tail track running between them, and was feeling imaginative, somewhat resembled hoof prints. Maybe, if the horse in question had a rather unusual gait and was slightly pigeon-toed. He settled himself under the cover of a hedge, watching the bird through the window. It was a little drab, but most unusual, and he was fairly certain that it wasn't an English bird, which meant it was not only imprisoned inside, but had been kidnapped from its own country. He couldn't just ignore that. He'd promised Mortimer there'd be no more turkey liberation operations this year. Amelia kept calling it stealing, but she was both such a tool of the establishment and his sister, so that was only to be expected. But no one had said anything about freeing foreign avian prisoners. For one moment, he thought of Mortimer's shedding tail, and how it tended to get worse when any sort of even mildly revolutionary work was involved. Then he pushed the thought away. No. He couldn't let the risk of Mortimer's bald patch stop him. This bird needed to be free. And he'd ask Miriam for some more coconut oil for Mortimer's tail. That would make up for it anyway. The man in the plaid jumper spent forever in the same room as the bird, making tea and a large ham and cheese sandwich. Gilbert's stomach growled at the idea of cheese, but he ignored it. Such were the privations of a freedom fighter. He sat sitting in a large easy chair with his back to the bird, while it puttered from one end of its perch to the other, obviously languishing in boredom and despair. The man watched TV and ate terribly slow, and before long Gilbert was languishing a little himself. There wasn't even anything very interesting on the TV that he could see. Just a lot of people shouting at each other, and bigger people holding them back now and then when they got too excited. He wondered if there were any more birds in the neighboring houses he could liberate first, then come back to this one. Or maybe some rabbits being held against their will. He was almost ready to go and investigate, even though he'd reconnoitered the whole street before deciding the parrot was his primary target. There were some hamsters in a cage a couple of doors over, but they were quite small and the cage was quite big, so he wasn't sure they really needed rescuing. Plus, the odds of Walter thinking they were afternoon tea were quite high if he took them back to the caverns. But just before he gave up his vigil, the man finally got up, switching the TV off. He washed his plate and mug, then wandered out of sight, returned with a heavy jacket on, vanished again, and finally Gilbert heard the slam of the front door. This was it. He scuttled forward, belly low to the ground, his flanks smeared with mud, and stripes daubed across his face. He'd even painted his talons green and brown, and taken his tail piercings out, in case the glint of light on them gave him away. He skirted a flower bed, took a quick look around, and dashed across the paved patio to the doors. The parrot was looking at him with interest, and he waved, trying to smile without showing any teeth. Far too many of those he liberated assumed he was going to eat them, and he would never. He was a vegetarian, as befitted a defender of the equality of all creatures. The parrot lifted a foot in return. So that was something. It complicated the rescue efforts when they panicked and started running about the place screeching. He glanced around again, got up on his haunches, and took some tools from a band around his foreleg. He'd had a particularly helpful dwarf make them up, and it was the work of a moment to open the lock. Magical lock picks work even better than the regular ones they're modeled on. "Hey," he said to the parrot, "don't be scared. I'm Gilbert. I'm here to set you free." "What?" the parrot said, startling him. The chickens never talked back. "You talk," he said. "So do you," the parrot said. "What are you anyway? Some sort of iguana?" "Okay," Gilbert said, wondering how this changed things. He'd never had to explain the situation before. "Sure, this is cool. Totally cool." "Shut the door," the parrot said. "It's cold out." Gilbert looked out at the garden. "I'm going to rescue you, so the door kind of needs to be open for our getaway." "Bollocks to that," the parrot said. "That's my door. Shut the damn thing." "Look, what's your name?"
"Bertie."
"Okay, Bertie, you're being held against your will," Gilbert said. "And I think you may have developed Stockport syndrome." That wasn't quite right, but he knew what he meant.
"Stock what?"
"Stockpot syndrome?" No, that wasn't it either. "Look, you're sympathizing with your captors and now want to stay, only you wouldn't if you were thinking straight."
"Well, you can get right off," Bertie said. Only it wasn't quite what he said.
Gilbert didn't recognize the word he used, but he thought it probably wasn't suitable for young dragons who weren't even in their 60s yet.
"Go on, and shut the bloody door behind you, you scaly little git."
"But I'm liberating you. I'm the resistance. A lone warrior railing against the terrible forces who would imprison you, howling for the freedom of all.
You're letting the cold in,"
Bertie bawled, and Gilbert jumped, stumbling onto the clean, pale wood floor in his muddy hoof socks.
"Oh, no," he said, looking down.
"Git," the parrot said, then suddenly straightened up.
"Shut the door! Quick, shut the damn door!"
"I won't let you accept your captivity. I can free you," Gilbert shouted, and scampered toward the parrot's perch to cut the little leash on his foot.
"Shut the door!"
Bertie shrieked, and from outside came the sudden thunder of a feathered invasion. Gilbert spun around, but the crows were already inside, sweeping past the dragon and the parrot to descend on the trays and tins of biscuits, shrieking in delight.
"Get out!" Bertie shouted at them.
"Sod off!" one of the crows shouted back.
"Bollocks!"
a second one jeered, and the third chortled, its beak already full of biscuit. Bertie glared at Gilbert.
"Look what you've done, you complete numpty!"
"Oh, no," Gilbert whispered. "This is even worse than the turkeys."
"Get them out,"
Bertie insisted.
"Right,"
Gilbert said, and approached the crows. Icing sugar hung in a cloud around the kitchen island, accompanied by a few feathers. He was still trailing mud everywhere, but that seemed rather less important than it had a moment ago.
"Right, you lot," he said, trying to sound authoritative. "You have to leave. You can't be in here."
The biggest crow looked at him, put his head on one side, and said,
"Crow wants a biscuit."
Gilbert stared at him, then at Bertie, who said something that was definitely unrepeatable. Gilbert had never actually been spoken to by a bird before, and now there were four of them, and they were all kind of rude. This was getting weird.
"Giz a kiss," one of the other crows shouted, inexplicably, and the rest of them cawed raucously.
Gilbert had the uncomfortable, and he was fairly sure accurate, feeling that they were laughing at him.
"You have to leave," he shouted at them. "This is a rescue mission for a captured foreign avian, and you're ruining it."
The crows stopped cawing and just stared at him, which was actually no improvement.
"You what?" one said. "You're going to ruin the mission," he said, feeling his camouflaged scales draining of color as a panicked lump rose in his throat. "You're endangering the movement."
The crows stared at him for a moment. Then one said,
"Nice tail," and the rest cawed in delight. "Get out," Gilbert yelled, wondering if he dared try singeing them. But that really went against his nonviolent values.
The birds looked at each other. Then the largest one said,
"Nah,"
and they turned their attention back to the biscuits, cawing around mouthfuls of sugary almond goodness and shouting something about baps.
"Cease and desist," Gilbert shouted. "Stand down. Look, just stop, okay?"
They didn't even look up, and Birdie shook his head, covering his beak with one claw.
"This is painful," he said,
and just as Gilbert decided he was going to have to free Birdie and make a run for it, leaving the crows to their rampage, Carlotta walked into the kitchen.
"Uh-oh," Birdie said.
"What is going on?" she screamed, dropping her bag on the floor. The crows launched themselves off the biscuits, scattering crumbs and icing sugar and feathers everywhere.
"Philip, did you leave the bloody door open? I swear to God."
"Nice buns," one of the crows screeched.
"Work it, baby,"
another yelled, swooping low over Carlotta's head.
"You,"
she roared, and Gilbert cowered on the floor, but she was pointing at Birdie.
"You taught them this."
"Me?" Birdie said, leaning back on his perch.
Gilbert considered the situation, then dived out the door under the cover of the crows, who, crazed on sugar and the delights of home invasion, were swooping around the big open-plan room, gleefully screaming expressions he was pretty sure he shouldn't learn.
"Hey!" Birdie yelled after him. "Get your scaly—"
He stopped, looking at Carlotta.
"Birdie want a biscuit," he said weakly.
"You'll get a feather duster," she shouted at him, grabbing a tea towel and giving chase to the crows.
"I'll turn you into one myself, you obscene, flea-ridden excuse for a bird."
"Harsh,"
Birdie muttered, and glared out the door at Gilbert, who was lingering on the edge of the patio, camouflaged among the shrubbery. Gilbert gave a guilty little shrug. One had to expect some setbacks. Not every mission could go smoothly. He just wished it hadn't been Carlotta's house it had gone so very unsmoothly in. She always gave him extra mince pies before Mortimer could eat them all. However, one had to consider the integrity of the overall movement, not just the individual mission. He slipped away into the fading afternoon, keeping to the gray shadows of the walls and looking for more victims of captivity. He'd make her a special tree topper. That should fix things. Behind him, a crow shrieked, "Show us your baps, love!" And Carlotta gave a war cry that set the crows screaming and him running a little faster. He might make that a tree topper, some baubles, and maybe some of the new jewelry he'd been working on. Just in case. And to round out the year is Tall Tale legend himself, Bill Lepp. From his book, Armadillo Recon Unit and Other Tall Tales, published in 2004, the chapter, Stop Sign Man. In the land of streets and corners, there were many heroes and villains, but the most heroic hero of them all was a young boy who stood only 3 feet tall. He was small in stature, but possessed of powers unknown heretofore to any creature that flew, walked, or crawled across the floor. He wore a cape and an armored suit of red. He carried neither sword nor wand, but a magic stop sign instead. Whenever there was mischief afoot, or a bad guy up to an evil design, Stop Sign Man would arrive in a rush, brandish his octagon, and shout, "Stop Sign!" And the evildoer would cease to do his evil doings thereabout. One day, while Stop Sign Man was walking through the woods, he heard a sudden scream and squeal. Rushing up the path, he found a family of picnickers besieged by bears trying to steal their meal. The picnickers were the Macaws, Martin, Martha, Mindy, Mike, and Neil. Martin McCall was warding off the bears with a chair and a bicycle wheel as Stop Sign Man rushed into the breach and pulled out his eight-sided, evil-ending sign of steel. Shouting, "Stop Sign!" in the faces of the thieving bears, Stop Sign Man pulled the picnic baskets from the bears' claws and returned them to the hungry and grateful Macaws. To the bears he said, "Next time remember that it is not nice to rob, thieve, or cheat. Now go home and make a sandwich if you wish to eat." Shamefaced, the bears beat a hasty retreat. Later, while walking by the beach, Stop Sign Man saw a ship anchored just out of reach. "Ahoy!" came a cry from the ship. "We are about to have our tea. Won't you come aboard and have a sip?" Suspicious of the Jolly Roger flying above the ship's deck, Stop Sign Man shouted back, "You are pirates, and I won't risk my neck." "Aye," yelled the pirate captain in a kindly voice, "we are but friendly sailors who dress as pirates by choice. Have no fear, we will not harm thee." Stop Sign Man flew to the ship, still not trusting the buccaneers, but thirsty for tea. Then, soon as Stop Sign Man had landed, he realized the pirates were naughty, mean, dirty, and underhanded. The really quite unfriendly pirates rushed at Stop Sign Man with swords rusted by oceanic brine. Acting quickly, Stop Sign Man bore his four-lettered scarlet peacemaker and shouted, "Stop Sign!" He arrested the pirates, read them their rights from his handy Miranda card, and then promptly turned the bandits over to the Coast Guard. Still thirsty, Stop Sign Man stepped toward a small cafe to see what cool drinks they might be selling. When he opened the door, he was greeted by harsh, brash, and ungrateful yelling. "My lands," he shouted over the din, "what evil is afoot in this place?" He heard two children's voices shouting, "Gimme, gimme, gimme," and "Mine, mine, mine." He saw the children fighting in the corner, while other patrons tried to dine. They grabbed and grunted, never said please, never uttered a thank you, burped loudly, and were otherwise crude. "Alas," Stop Sign Man muttered to himself, "it is the enemies of all decency, Carmen and Cameron Rude." Unstrapping his blazing red metal manner mender, Stop Sign Man strode to the Rude twins and shouted, "Stop Sign, please!" Mid-belch, Carmen and Cameron Rude had their rotten manners miraculously mended, and there and then they changed their impolite attitude. "Thank you for saving us from a life coarse, boorish, and rude," said the twins, who now no longer suffered from social ineptitude. Leaving the cafe, Stop Sign Man serenely strolled down the lane, sipping milk that was ice cold. He noticed three kids flying brightly colored kites at the playground, but he also heard a darkly sinister sound. Over the hill, sitting high in their saddles, rode the three dark knights who most hated kites. Stop Sign Man had fought many battles with these darkly armored marauders, in parks, field, beaches, and twice in harbors. They lowered their lances, wielded their swords, unslung their slings, and set about to try to cut the three kites' strings. of all the dirty, rotten, low-down things!" shouted Stop Sign Man as he threw his cool drink aside and looked for his own horse to ride. Charging straight at the knights who most hated kites, Stop Sign Man unscabbard his red and white street sign of power and might, shouting, "Stop Sign!" But he did not yell at the knights themselves, but rather at the wind. And as with all things that Stop Sign Man signed, the wind could not help but mind. The kites lingered but a moment in the windless sky, and then dropped to the ground with a soft sigh. But the knights, who most hated kites, were in a bind, for they had aimed their weapons quite high. Their winded horses whinnied and whined as the kites attempted to re-aim their swords and rewind their slings, but all three knights lost their balance before they could do any of those things. They hit the ground and rolled around, and at last their leader spoke, "Stop Sign Man, again you have ruined our plan. One day we shall capture you and tie you up like a pig in a poke." Stop Sign Man merely laughed and said, "Dark Knight, that is quite a joke." As Stop Sign Man was riding his horse over hill and dale, he heard a girl who had just begun to weep and wail. Stop Sign Man passed an ox-drawn wagon, just in time to see Princess Cora about to be singed by a fire-breathing dragon. Guiding his horse between the dragon and the distressed but royal dame, Stop Sign Man wielded his rosy polygon of goodness and, shouting, "Stop Sign!" shielded the princess from the flame. The flame, obeying the command, stopped mid-air. Stop Sign Man grabbed the frozen flame with a dashing flare, turned it around, and shoved it back down the dragon's reptilian throat with a mighty shout. The dragon coughed and wheezed, blowing backward smoke from his snout. He looked forlornly at Stop Sign Man and whimpered softly, "If I promise to be nice, will you please take the backwards fire out?" Stop Sign Man, seizing this unique opportunity, made the dragon swear to be good and always do his duty. The dragon agreed to forever uphold the laws of the land of streets and corners and by goodness to abide. And then, surprising both the princess and Stop Sign Man, the dragon agreed to be Stop Sign Man's loyal magic ride. Princess Cora and Stop Sign Man climbed upon the dragon's scaly back, and the three of them flew off into the Stop Sign Red Sunset. We've run out of time for today's episode of That's Halaf. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen next time. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, wishing you a very happy new year. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. That's a Laugh is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other NCRS shows, please call us at 919-832-5138. Our number one more time is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.